You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
We like to think of parks as preserved bits of pristine wilderness. In Vancouver, Stanley Park is touted as a remarkable piece of forest that has somehow been protected against the encroachment of this city's urban center. But an exploration into the origins of Stanley Park reveals a very different history. At the time that the park was created in 1888, numerous families lived there, as they had for many years. In 1958, the last of these residents were pushed out, and virtually all traces of their existence there were erased. Jean Barman is the author of Stanley Park's Secret, The Forgotten Families of Hoi Hoi, Hunt Kanaka Ranch, and Brockton Point, and she has joined us by phone this morning. Hello, Jean.
Hello, nice to talk to you.
In all the times that I've been in Stanley Park, I really don't remember ever seeing any markers or monuments to people who once lived there. Is there any physical sign of the families who lived in the area?
There's a tiny, tiny plaque on the beach below the entry to the bridge, the Lionsgate Bridge, that's about maybe 9 inches by 15 inches, and it says that this is once the site of Chasu's, but that's all that I've been able to find.
And despite any kind of physical reminder, in your book you describe a really remarkably diverse group of people who lived in three different communities. If you could generalize, could you tell us a little bit about who these people were?
Well, the first group, and the most important group historically, are Aboriginal people who had used the park and its resources, cedar fishing around the edges for generations immemorial, to use the usual term. And they continued to live in a number of areas around the park. The two biggest sites were Hoi Hoi, which is in the title of the book, which is now was renamed Lumberman's Arch, and Chasu's, which, as I said, is near Prospect Point under the Lionsgate Bridge. And then there were gold miners that from the beginning of the 1860s settled down, became fishermen, settled down women who were mainly Squamish and probably lived there before in the area both sides, north and south of Prospect Point, which is where the totem poles are now. The third group I talk about at Kanaka Ranch didn't end up in the park. They're on the other side of Cole Harbor at the foot of Denman Street, which is now a wholly developed area, but at the time was very similar. It's very similar to the peninsula would become Stanley Park. Just remember now that this was not a park. This was just a place that existed on the southern side of Burrard Inlet.
And the families that lived there, as a result of these very diverse communities that were that had come together and were living in the same place, a lot of the children who lived in the communities in Stanley Park were of mixed ethnicity, and you talk right about how nearly all of them were taken away to residential schools. What was the impact of the residential schools on these particular children and communities?
Well, it was certainly not what officials had in mind when, in fact, during the 1890s and into the beginning of the 20th century, took children to residential school. They wanted to get them to get away from the park, also to fill up the residential schools, which had difficulty attracting Aboriginal children. In this case, it was mainly Coquelitza in the Fraser Valley, where the local Stalo people didn't think it was such a good idea that their children would be put away in this three-story brick building for years on end. And so essentially the children that were living, both some children from Hoi Hoi, completely Squamish children, also some children, many children from Brockton Point, children from Kanaka Ranch, were scooped up into the residential school to be treated as if they were Indian children. And if you went to residential school, the purpose was, to be a bit cynical, was to get you out of the way, make sure you're out of the way, and to tell you, to give you the lessons that you could do menial work, but basically you were meant to go back to your reserve and you were meant not to get in the way of newcomer society. And the irony is that they did go back, but what was their reserve? Their reserve was essentially what had now become a park, Stanley Park, and so they went back there and were even more committed to this place where they had been born, where they'd grown up, and which they considered to be their own.
And how did the area come to be established as a park in 1888 if all of these communities and families were living there? What was the process of turning this area into a park?
Well, two things were happening. First of all, as you said, these are families which, for the most part, are either Squamish or they're interracial in the sense that the mothers are Squamish or Aboriginal and the fathers are Scots or Portuguese or other people who've come with the gold rush. And mainstream society tended, these were people denigrated as half-breeds, and mainstream society denigrated them. On the other hand, they were somewhat invisible because nobody wanted to acknowledge their presence. And so they weren't a main factor. And the reason it becomes a park is if you want to be gentle, it's very strategic. If you want to be cynical, it's a bit crass. And that is that urban parks are a 19th century fashion. I mean, there's Central Park in New York where the same process goes on, Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera, Regent's Park in London. And the idea is that this is the Industrial Revolution. A lot of very fairly poor people, honest people, are being moved from the countryside into the cities because of possibility for more work. And if you give them a park, what you do is you give them some kind of reflection of the light of nature, the natural world they left behind, which is why parks have to be natural. And the second reason, of course, is that most of the people who are in charge in major cities, such as Vancouver, formed when the railroad comes in 1886, are land developers. The city fathers are big land developers, and they don't want, they don't want this big piece of land, which is a peninsula, almost 1,000 acres, put on the market because it will drive down their prices. And secondly, they want this natural, supposedly natural place in proximity because it will drive up their prices for the land that they have to sell. And this is what happens.
So then once that decision was made to turn this into a park, how were the people actually removed from the land that they had been living on for so many generations?
Well, the earliest to be removed were the Aboriginal people. In the first descriptions of them from the beginning of the 1860s, they're named as being Squamish. There probably were more diverse people, including Musqueam, who are living there, but they're called Squamish. They are denied a government reserve. They're denied an Indian reserve. They're denied an Indian reserve on the grounds, which seems silly to us today, that the white people had gotten there first. And by this, it's not meant the people who are living in the park, but the people in charge, the British colonial officials, the naval officers, etc. And then the other families are, but Squamish people continue to live there until the 1920s. In any case, they don't pay much attention to it for the most part, to the fact that they supposedly don't belong there. The other people, families of Brockton Point, are removed through a legal case that's instituted in 1923. The federal government and the city of Vancouver use want to dispossess them. And there's a concept in British common law called adverse possession or squatter's rights, which is if you live somewhere for 60 years and nobody has removed you, you have a right to that land. And so the defendants, who are these families, have to prove 60 years possession, either themselves or through the properties being handed down. And they and most of the people now who are going to have been there 60 years before are Aboriginal people, Squamish people. There's a series of really, I think, very presentable witnesses. But the judge in the BC Supreme Court says, basically, you can't trust Indian evidence. Indians have no sense of time. He rules against them. The really interesting factor, I think, and it's very admirable, is in the BC Court of Appeals, two of the three judges actually rule for the families and say they have proven their case. It goes to the Supreme Court of Canada, and the Supreme Court of Canada essentially says tersely that, yes, Indians have no sense of time. I agree with the judge in the BC Supreme Court, and so they're dispossessed.
I'm really struck by how, despite this, how long it took for this forced removal to be complete, I'm really struck by how little evidence there is of this whole process and these lives. How did you go about gathering the information for this book?
Well, it's not a book I intended to write. It came about and only was possible because of descendants talking to me, because I've written other books about British Columbia history, and they wanted me to write the story, and at first I resisted, and eventually I was intrigued. But it's this case where, you know, there's some things in the past but which we don't know, and we know that we don't know. And in this case, I didn't know that I didn't know. I thought this was, how could this story be the case? In fact, if we don't have, if it's not in the public record. But once I committed myself to doing it, and I read things such as the Vancouver Parks Board minutes, you can see all of the signs are there. You see references such as, oh, this old Indian woman has infected trees. Let's get rid of her. There were Chinese people as well living in the park, and they just used the health card against them and just got rid of them. And all of this is embedded in the Parks Board minutes, but if you only have the Parks Board minutes, there are these fragments, and they don't tell you anything. Other scholars have used the Parks Board minutes. But once you start with the family stories, and I'm really indebted to all of the many descendants who have, you know, supported me and shared what they remember of their childhoods in the park and their parents' experiences in the park, then the rest of it falls into place.
And what has been the response to this book since it came out last year, I believe?
Well, it's rather like a commercial. It's around. Those who like it a lot. A lot of people are really have become concerned. I mean, I'm a historian. My job is to present it for other people who want to become activists and say, as I agree fully, that there should be, you know, the history of Stanley Park should remember the history of Stanley Park should be remembered in the park. It shouldn't just be the park that supposedly evokes the natural or evokes all of the zillion memorials and monuments that are there, mainly to white people who've, you know, Shakespeare, you know, the whole litany. I think that the time for action is here. I hope something will happen and that the book will raise consciousness enough so that these families will be remembered. And particularly, I think, that the families from Hoihoi and Chesus, the Squamish families, will be remembered as more than just kind of archaeological sites, which is what the official statement of the Vancouver Parks Board is that these are pre-contact sites. And that's just totally not true, in the same way that these families who lived at Brockton Point, they were there. They were there until 1958, and to pretend that this didn't happen is, I think, just, you know, silly, if nothing worse.
Well, thank you for sharing this information with us and telling us about the process of gathering it.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I've been speaking with Jean Barman. She is the author of Stanley Park's Secret, as well as several other books on British Columbia's history. And you are listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.